Mr. Gay Wan Gui, Rue 22.
Yes, very few of the important installations were destroyed. I mean, they preserved, actually. They were preserved, actually, and soon everything was restored. But the most important thing was the birth of a new spirit of independence among the young people. Even the older people, the leaders, felt that it was time that they realized that the white supremacy was a myth, that the Japanese had come and shown that Asians could overthrow the white authority, that it was time that independence should be taken seriously. And it was the awakening of the Chinese school students whose mind were beginning to be captured by the communist indoctrination. That's the most serious thing, and that was the beginning of this political awakening. You can see all this in the story of the awakening series shown on TV.
Was it immediately felt?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't immediately felt. But you could feel the pride of the people when the anti-Japanese army marched in triumph and recognized as one of the factors that brought the downfall of the Japanese.
Did you observe any changes in attitudes towards the British by the local people during that time?
Yes, I think so, you know. At that time, there was already a difference that we felt the British were not superhuman, supermen as we used to think. And we remember seeing them in the long marches to Changi Jail, to Siam Road. It was a pitiful sight, you know. Some of them saw their bosses marching haltingly, lamely, and some of them begging for water and so on. After all, they were just as human, with human frailties like us.
How did you observe these changes in the people's attitudes?
Well, I felt it myself, in a way. I saw it with my own eyes. And the people were no longer cringing, you know, like before. Yes, sir. Stammered and could hardly reply when they were addressed to by a European, you see, or an Englishman. But now they could look at a European straight in the eye. See? Some other the psychological breakthrough happened. The Superman image was broken. This was essential. And with regard to this capturing the minds of the young by communist doctrine seeping through the Chinese high school and so on, it was a very real thing. And to the trade unions, to the Hockney bus strike, and so on. And that was a political awakening which followed this feeling that independence was ripe. Of course, the more intellectual of us did not use such forceful methods. We formed groups, discussion groups in houses, but they were just as dangerous. Like P.V. Sharma, Lim Hong Bi, Lim Ken Sui, and then a few others. The original communists, Mr. Devanaya, our president, they all formed groups and had held meetings discussing about Fabianism, you see, about socialism, about all forms of political ideologies. And the first thing they did was to form the Malian Democratic Union. You're a historian, you know all these things, right? At Bras Basah, I was a member. We tried to form a cooperative, tried to get things cheap. Right? And that started the idea of the socialism and unionism and people your Republic of China's ideas of coming in and so on. And what one day this came into a kind of action in our school itself. You know. The new principal came to our school. We were having an assembly and singing songs. And I was standing next to the principal was just speaking. We were singing hymns, I think. No, we were singing hymns. And suddenly, six young fellows, students, teenagers, came in, and two of them were wielding, I'm sure they were not real guns, toy guns, and asked us for our IC. And at that time, it was the first time that everybody over 12 had to have an identity card. So we all took our IC and they tore our IC to bits and threw on the ground.
When was that?
That was nearly a year after the independence. Nearly a year after the occupation.
British reoccupation.
To show that don't take the British government seriously. And the other teachers said, you are a senior master, why didn't you shout and blow your whistle and get all the boys to jump on them? I said, don't be silly, you have not seen what these youngsters can do. Suppose they had carried real guns and started shooting. Are you going to pay for the lives of these young boys?
Mr. K, when you came back from Endow, did you know what happened to Endow settlement?
No, it died a natural death. Nobody, it was deserted, and several people went back to see. It was deserted and overgrown. A few people just stayed on because they had nowhere else to go. But now it's a very small place. There were still some people living on. I don't know what land titles they have, what their arrangements they have with the Johor government.
When you came back, how did you adjust to life in Singapore during the first few months?
As I said, I stayed first in my friend's house, which was big, and he had the servants' quarters all empty, and stayed there for some time. Then I moved to a house in C Avenue. After that, I had my job back, and my wife had her job, and everything went on normally. Schools. Schools were started, and there was a lot of readjustment, especially with regard to the children who lost 3 years of their education. It was a difficult time for them. Standards were very difficult to adjust. Most of them were overaged, and some of them missed their education so badly that you get children of 10 years old studying primary one. In primary one, you see.
When did you get back your job?
Well, I got my job practically the moment I came back, as you say, the moment from the date of the Japanese surrender, we had our back pay, if I was not mistaken. And there were friends who were willing to advance money for us to tide over the period of difficulty.
Where did you go to?
And, I think the British paid us the back pay for the period of occupation also, if I'm not mistaken. That's how I bought my car.
Where did you go to get back your job in the school?
The Ministry of Education.
Was the school still in the same place?
Yes, the same place.
When you went back to school, was it already functioning?
The desks and chairs were there. It must have been because there were chalk dust and so on. How well it was functioning, I wouldn't know.
Were there already teachers teaching?
Yes, the principal was a certain Mr. I can't remember his name. An Irishman, who was the principal, Eurasian Irishman. Yes, it was the Japanese school of the Japanese occupation. It was carried on right to the end.
When you went back, there were already students and teachers?
Yes. And then, of course, there was a reshuffling. They went back to their original schools, and some other teachers came back to our school and so on.
Did they start with, where did they get the new syllabus and the textbooks and all that?
We always could refer to the old books. If you open any textbook, you get a series. Any series, any book will tell you what books to use for what standard quite easily. So different schools, I think, would have roughly different books. Like geography books, new geography series, book 1, book 2 for what standard, book 3, book 4 for what standard, book 5, book 6 for what standard, and so on. Or everyday English, and that kind of thing, is it? It depends on what series you use, and there was miscellaneous types in those days, no standard types. No such thing as a federal publications.
What kind of difficulties and problems did you encounter as a teacher during this period of readjustment and change?
As I said, it's an age problem. The age problem, the adjustment. Difficult to teach children of 10 in primary 1.
Mr. Gay, how did you think the period of Japanese occupation affected your personal life?
Well, it taught me a lot of things. I mean, first, it taught me to be independent and to change my attitude and evaluate things differently. Yeah, there are certain things which are really not important, and things that are really more lasting and more important. In time of war and difficulties, such things as friendship, cooperation, kindness, understanding, and food, availability of good environment, place to live in, basic necessities of life, good health, are more important than material wealth, and understanding and love and affection of your your neighbors and friends are more important than all the wealth in the world. All the sophisticated life that we see around us today, which can become very monotonous and very hard and very unfeeling and cold, and gives us a lot of confidence, like going to an outward bound school where you are left alone to fend for yourself from scratch. There is a piece of land, now go out and survive, that sort of thing. And when you can do it, you feel that you have achieved some sort of thing, you see? So this is an education for life.
Did you think it affected your career?
It has, in a way, because I got involved in politics. I got involved in politics.
How did the occupation get you involved?
Huh? Because I was very keen on socialism. I read a lot of Bernard Shaw and books of the Fabian Society and so on. Whatever books on socialism there was, I would leave my hands on, from Karl Marx and so on. And I was thinking that these were ideals. Then I found that they were all wrong, that it was very dangerous. Communism was a very dangerous doctrine. And the PAP and the Barisan Socialists, they came, they were, first of all, it was the Barisan Socialists and the PAP fighting each other, right? They're fighting each other. If you study them carefully, the Barisan Socialists were the real communists. You see, the PAP wasn't. But at first, I was thinking that the PAP wasn't able to defeat the Barisan Socialists. That they were all of the same group. I did not know, you see. I did not know. What I should have done was to join on one side. But myself, that I was so silly, I went to be persuaded to join the Liberal Socialists. So I joined the Liberal Socialists. And then I must have made a mess of things, written some manifestos. So don't join politics. If one wants to be in the civil service, the best is don't touch politics at all.
How did the occupation, you mentioned that the occupation affected your career in a sense that it got you involved in politics. Where was the link?
The link was that, you see, it showed me that you could sort of, life could be simplified more. There could be more equality, more justice, and so on. That these people could live in communities where everybody could have a chance, it would be fairer, distribution, that kind of thing. When you're young, when you're younger, you could be more idealistic, and you thought that you could do something. In fact, you want to have a hand in a new independent Singapore, that was all. See? And you didn't want to be involved with the old form of government that was connected with the English type of bureaucracy. So, and as you said, you backed the wrong person, the wrong party. That was a mistake. Because I started left wing. I started with the MDU.
You mean the period of Japanese occupation gave you the ideas of socialism and all that?
Yes, very early. Even at college days. I was with Kenneth Byrne, Yong Nyuk Lin. I was even before Goh Keng Swee, a year before Goh Keng Swee. You don't believe it, Yong Nyuk Lin. And I'm glad the PAP has managed to, as you say, ride the tiger and tame the tiger, control the tiger. You see? And it was a very serious thing, this feeling of independence and the spirit that grew in the hearts of the young students. Luckily, it was strong. You cannot blame them. They perform a function. They perform a job. If not because of them, we wouldn't have got our independence today. You agree with me? Yeah? Although it was a risk, but the risk to be taken, you see. With one operation, but fortunately also there is a man to be able to see and direct that energy and transform into the proper channel and you get Singapore what it is today. It's very fascinating. Of course, I read stories about the causes of war, the armaments king, the capitalists behind armaments race, how they live on the blood and destruction of mankind to getting wealth through armaments and destruction and forces of destruction, and the evils of capitalism, how unjust is the distribution of wealth, how some people work so hard and get a pittance of a living, and how some people do not even raise a finger and they seem to get everything. So this unfair distribution, can be made fairer. How can we do it? Through what method? Through our present method of this, then the increased taxation, our present system of economic administration, or what? And I've been thinking of the different economic systems. And about these bankers and banking, they get people into debt, like today. Who are the people who get the world into trouble? All these banks and so on, causing the new nations to get into debt. And all these things, I think of the settlement, the people in the settlement. We owe nobody anything. We bring what we have. What little we have, about 10,000 of us. We use our bare hands. We have so much rice, we eat. We breathe the air. We fish. In fact, we live so close to nature, we seem to be able to sustain ourselves with not very much. In fact, my wife even accused me of reading Shakespeare under the tree. What's wrong with reading Shakespeare under a tree when I feel like it? So I was thinking to myself, what's wrong with this kind of life? So if socialism can bring down all these complicated system, economic system, to a simpler system of distribution of wealth, and create more happiness and eliminate all bad attitudes towards life, feelings and so on, why not? Why not make life simpler and less complicated for everybody, so they can enjoy nature and the things that God has given us. So that sort of thing that has influenced me.
For you, Enda was an example.
Exact example.
Mr. Gate, do you have any more things to say about your experiences during the Japanese occupation period?
No, I think that's all.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gate.